This meeting can come to order. Good morning, everyone. We have, I believe it's 5 bills on the calendar today, so brevity and clarity are values in this committee. Representative Briners, good morning. The chair moves House File 1048 to be recommended to pass and be referred to Committee on Commerce and Labor. I knew I could get there. Representative Briners.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
House File 1048 extends unemployment benefits to workers with reduced hours who participate in targeted training through the Wired Federal Grant Program. This extension is offered as a variation of the Shared Work Plan and Minnesota Statute 268.135. There are three aspects to the bill. The first is the experience of a high technology business in the current economic downturn. We have with us today Dennis Seymour, who is CEO of VTech Incorporated, which designs and manufactures component processing equipment. Mr. Seymour will speak to his company's experience.
Mr. Seymour, good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Dabney, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present. I'm Dennis Seymour. I'm the CEO of VTech Incorporated in Mankato, Minnesota. We employ 65 people there, and we manufacture electronic component handling equipment. It's automated for the robotic assembly process in the electronics industry. The current economic conditions have impacted our business. We sell this equipment to 34 different countries, and we found a tremendous decline in sales, and this is makes a difficult time for us, but it's also an opportunity for us to provide training for our employees. We'd like to use this time to give them additional education and training in their trades and related fields at this point, but cash flow is extremely tight. We're fortunate to get the Wired grant, but one of the things that would be extremely beneficial is to be able to allow these people to participate in education while they are on a shared work program through the unemployment compensation. By doing this, we will enable them to maintain their living standards. They will be able to stay employed with us and collect and have their full employment benefits, just as they always have. We put them on a 32-hour week, and they would have the remaining time to go to school. They would be see very little loss in income, and they would be encouraged to stay with the company by seeing that we are concerned for them as well as us. We'd have new products being developed, and down the road in 1 or 2 years, as the economy improves, we will have new products on the market at that time ready for sale. And this will be further ensure the business of success and, of course, the employee's success along with it. They also have, because they of this training, they would have the opportunity to increase their earnings, and this would be a benefit not only to them, but to the state as well.
Thank you, Mr. Seymour. Representative Briner, do you seem to have someone else there with you?
Yes, I do have someone else who's probably familiar to you. And Mr. Seymour has already mentioned the second and third aspects of the bill, which are the Shared Work Plan, which was first created in statute in 1994, and its goal was to reduce layoffs. And the third is the Wired Program, which is a federal grant designed to build talent in rural Minnesota to support the renewable energy industry. And Lee Nelson from BEAD is with us today to describe how the Shared Work Program and Wired came together in this proposal to support situations like those described by Mr.
Nelson. Mr. Nelson, welcome back.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I am the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program. The Shared Work Program has been in place in Minnesota since 1994. And what it is a program which a group of employees take reduced hours to prevent layoffs. and then unemployment benefits are used to supplement part of the loss in income if a workers are a group of workers are reduced from 5 days a week to 4 days a week, and that loss of pay for a day is partially supplemented by unemployment benefits. And as I say, that program has been around since 1994. That program does not have a lot of flexibility built in it. We are currently looking at legislation regarding the program in general. But we were approached by some of the individuals, including the individual on my left, and he indicated that he had the shared work program currently wouldn't fit. So we were looking at this bill simply waives the restrictions the shared work program has on the minimum number of employees, and that the workers be hourly rather than salary, and a few of the other restrictions. We'd like Wired to be a success. We have worked with Representative Brinert in drafting this legislation. The department fully supports this legislation and hopes that Wired will be a success and can be expanded considerably throughout Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Any questions to the author or the testifiers from committee members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 1048? Representative Brinert, any last comments?
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, I'd like to say that this bill is intended to help preserve jobs, particularly those of skilled workers. It will function as a pilot under the Shared Worker Plan, and with targeted assistance, it has an expiration date, so we'll observe and learn whether further expansion of the Shared Work Plan is warranted. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. With that, the Chair renews his motion that House File 1048 be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in support, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Representative Brinert. Representative Mullery. The Chair moves that House File 903 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Mullery, good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, to get the bill in the shape that the author wants it, would you move the Amendment 0078, which has been in the packet?
The Chair moves the A090078 to be before the committee. Representative Mullery, this is your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Do you care to speak to it at all?
Well, I was going to do that in the presentation.
Right. We can handle it that way. All those in favor of the author's amendment A090078, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Mullery, do your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Back in 2004, some of you remember that we passed a law barring foreclosure consultants from being paid until they had fully performed their services. Unfortunately, there's a new group that are now targeting people and getting around the previous law. For instance, everybody knows that there's a lot of modification going on, and so they run ads or other ways solicit people who are not yet technically in default or foreclosure, and therefore groups are getting around the statute. There's also a problem, and this is why we have the amendment amendments, is that just about anybody can run over to the Secretary of State's office and file a nonprofit corporation, whereas this amendment will limit it to 501c3s under the Federal Internal Revenue Code, so that we actually know that they're a charitable corporation. There's plenty of groups out there doing this for free, but there's scam artists that are now trying to poke holes in the statute, which Mr. Chairman, you and I voted for back in 2004. And what this does is, if you look at it, on the top of page 2, in the first two lines, it extends it so that if any terms of an existing residential mortgage loan, not if they're, it doesn't require that they already be in default or in foreclosure. And then down in the people who are exempted in lines 2.29 through 2.33, we exempted mortgage originators or servicers, but what we want to do there with this clause is make sure that 325N.04 clause 1 in line 2.31 means that the service or the person doing the servicing and negotiation cannot be paid until they've completed their service that they've agreed to do. And this line means that they have to have done their negotiation and if it's on an existing residential mortgage loan. So if that does not apply, if it's the origination, but if it's on an existing loan, those servicers are not exempt until they've completed their service on it. And the same, I'm sorry for my cold this morning. On line 3.1 and 3.2, they also have to have completed their servicing or their negotiation before they can be paid. And then that's the same under what service under 3.24 means that service means that contacting creditors or servicers to negotiate the conditions of an existing residential mortgage loan. So we're making sure that what used to be apparently it's now become a little bit ambiguous what we passed and we thought we covered. We're now having to close loopholes that they're trying to poke holes in the law that we passed and thought we had it all covered. And Mr. Chairman, members, this morning we have Ms. Carla Heil from the Attorney General who can explain in detail their lawsuits that they've had and why this is needed to close these loopholes that people are trying to get into.
All right. Thanks, Representative Mueller and Ms. Heil. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name, record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Assistant Attorney General Carla Heil. And as Representative Mulry said, the Minnesota legislature in 2004 did enact a law to prevent foreclosure consultants from charging a fee or collecting a fee before they fully perform the services. And the Attorney General's office has filed 12 lawsuits in the past year against foreclosure consultants who have gotten approximately $2,000 up front and never performed the services of preventing foreclosure. And we have gotten consent decrees against various companies where they must cease and desist operations in Minnesota and they must give full restitution to the citizens or consumers where they charged a fee and never performed the service. And the foreclosure consultants, as Representative Mulry has said, they now target people who are not in foreclosure yet. Instead, they just are on hard times. And they do that by direct mailing, by phone solicitation, through their websites. And as Representative Mulry said, what this language in the proposed bill does is tighten the laws that we have, where it closes those loopholes and then clarifies that the public policy is it's not just absolute foreclosure, instead it is also the distressed homeowners that are being targeted.
Thank you, Ms. Heil. Questions for the author or testifier? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 903? Representative Mueller, any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for your attention and thanks for your help on closing these loopholes and what we thought we already had done.
It's our economy seems to be a leaky boat, Representative Mulery. With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 903 is amended, be recommended to pass, and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Representative Mulery. Representative Knuth. She's not here. Okay. Then we will go on to, she's on her way. We will drum our fingers on the desktop briefly.
Okay.
Okay.
Define briefly.
60 seconds tops. You know, we're doing so good. Clipping along. How's your day, Representative Mahoney?
It's been it's the best day of the week so far. You know, it's been really very nice. My cell phone gets to be turned off at 4 o'clock today.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Don't have to turn it back on until Monday.
Very good.
Yeah, I'm very happy
very
with
good.
That.
The credit is safe.
Yeah, you know, check his per diem.
You know, I have constituents all up and down my neighborhood.
Taking out the garbage, they stop you, they want to talk public policy.
I have a couple of people with personal care attendants on the block that every time they see me, they want to talk to me.
I could imagine that's
yeah,
true.
Yeah, they do. They're senior citizens in there. So, and a few others.
Okay.
How's your day going?
Just fine. I had a pleasant breakfast with some of my favorite labor thugs. You know that that's a term of affection.
Step out in the hall, I'll tell you how.
They were nice to me this time. That's not always been the case, but they were nice this time. And I paid for my own breakfast.
Does anyone know if we're on camera?
Pardon? All right. Representative Silver, could you take the chair, please?
We're going to be hearing House File 914 then until a little bit change in the agenda. And just as after the bill is introduced, we'll probably try to allocate about 10 minutes for the pros and cons on each side. So if you're intending to testify, make sure that your testimony is concise and not repeating. We'll try our best to hear everybody and this particular issue. Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 914 to be before the committee, recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
And members, you've heard the motion before us. Representative Dabney, you want to explain your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I don't need to tell you that these are difficult economic times for our state, our nation, perhaps most importantly, our constituents. A time, as President Obama has said, a time of reckoning has arrived. Too many of our constituents find themselves deeply in debt, challenged by stagnant wages and rising health care costs of the last decade, exacerbated by layoffs, falling home values, as we just visited with Representative Mullery's bill, and a collapsing stock market. Our responsibility as policymakers is to make sure that our constituents, when entering the financial services marketplace, have responsible and prudent options before them that strike the appropriate balance between the consumer and the business. Options that allow for prudent and responsible financial decisions on the part of our constituents. House File 914 strikes that balance. It is a very different proposal than either of the payday lending bills that were heard by and passed by this committee last year. The essence of this proposal is simply to allow consumers to build a bridge out of their immediate financial challenges. With me today is Mr. Ron Elwood with the Legal Services Advocacy Project.
I think it represents Mr. Elwood.
Thank you.
Identify yourself for the day, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I'm delighted to be here in support of Representative Dabney's bill. I know we have had a lot of discussion about payday lending and the problems that payday lending can cause for borrowers. It is in your packets, I believe you have a number of pieces of material. And I just want to point out a couple of things. First of all, according to the statistics from the states that actually keep statistics on the serial borrowing, in other words, how many loans that each person gets, we do not do that here in Minnesota. This bill would actually include that as a piece of reporting information for us. But the states that do collect the data already, the facts are pretty clear. About 25% of the payday loans made go to people that have 21 or more loans a year. About 60% of the loans made go to people that have 12 or more a year. So while the industry, and on its own website, the industry's website will tell you that this is for a short-term, one-time emergency. It should not be used for long-term financial support. The facts are that many people just get caught in the quicksand. And I would just refer to your packets, the article by Jane Bryan Quinn in Newsweek from a couple of years ago. The headline says it all. Payday loans can be a trap. There's another handout in your packets, an article from a TV spot out in Nebraska just this past January. It cites an economist who talks about the positives and negatives of payday lending. His quote is this: "We think the positive impact does not fully offset the negative impact. We estimate that approximately 10 to 11 million per year is lost or leaked out of the metro area economy." And that's just in one city in Nebraska. And finally, I'd like to point out the article by New York Times columnist David Brooks in a large diatribe about how our society has sunk into a debt-ridden one and we rely on debt instead of savings. I would like to just quote a couple of pieces. He says, "The institutions that encourage debt and living for the moment have been strengthened. The country's moral guardians are forever looking out for decadence out of Hollywood and reality TV, but the most rampant decadence today is financial decadence, the trampling of decent norms about how to use and harness money." And later on in the article, he says, "Payday lenders have also played a role. They seductively offer fast cash at absurd interest rates to 15 million people every month." Representative Dabney's bill does not touch the rates under current Minnesota law, whether it's the 685% they can get under Section 4759 for a $100 loan, or the 390% others are limited to under Chapter 4760. What this does is create an ability of people to get out of the quicksand. And I would just offer one final comment, which is this. We have seen other states that have passed laws that allow voluntary repayment plans. And indeed, I suspect you're going to hear from our opponents right after us that say they already offer voluntary payment plans. But I can tell you, when you look at the statistics and when you look at the other states that have done this, a dismally small number, and let me go even beyond that, an abysmally small number of people actually take advantage of these voluntary repayment schedules. So I think at this point I'll stop, and we do have some other folks that can walk you through the bill.
Any questions for Mr. Elwood? Any questions? Do you have others that are here to testify for the bill?
I do. Professor Princess Cox from the University of Minnesota Law School and Ms. Kari Rudd, students at the University of Minnesota Law School, are here to present the bill.
Welcome to the committee, and Professor, if you can identify yourself for the tape, it would help if you spell your last name.
Princess Cox, COX. University of Minnesota Law School, Associate Professor of Clinical Law.
Continue on.
Thank you. I will very briefly go through the provisions of the bill. The bill, the key to the bill is that it allows the, is that it creates a new section of Minnesota law that incorporates payday lenders under the existing 4760 authority, as well as companies that provide payday loans under 4759 as industrial loan and thrift companies typically. The new section then imposes certain obligations on those lenders in terms of the number and types of loans. Lenders can make essentially three loans. The plain language of the law will say the lender can't make another loan if it's made a loan to the borrower within the last 6 months, but then it authorizes two additional payday loans after that in response to loan inquiries by the borrower. On the fourth loan, the third time there's a loan inquiry about refinancing or repayment in any form broadly construed, the lender must offer the borrower what is defined in the bill under the definitions as a conventional term loan. That loan has a payment term, which is payment interval, which is the same as the payday loan, and a payment amount that's $1 less than the amount required for the lowest periodic payment, exclusive of principal on the consumer short-term loan made to the borrower. That's saying essentially you have to offer the kind of loan where the borrower is actually paying off principal over a period of time rather than the type of loan where the borrower is paying only fees to roll it over. The bill then also discourages, it's important, as Mr. Elwood was mentioning, that this not be a voluntary program because the voluntary program has just abysmally failed. There's absolutely no evidence anywhere that's been adopted that they've worked. And the reason for that is probably pretty simple, which is that the, you know, payday lenders are the sophisticated parties in control of the transaction. This is the exact same dynamic we see in all subprime or less than prime lending, where you have complicated financial products offered by the sophisticated borrowers. The bill then prohibits discouraging inquiries on conventional term loans. The loans have to be offered, and the bill says the borrower, the lenders cannot discourage the borrowers from taking those loans or from making inquiries, which would trigger the requirement of offering those loans. Finally, in the remaining subdivisions, the bill sets forth mandatory terms that have to be in the contract. It incorporates fair debt collection provisions in existing Minnesota law, which also bootstraps in federal law on fair debt collection practices, and it provides for detailed record-keeping requirements that would allow this state to track these consequences of for the borrowers on the type of loans that are provided. It also makes it clear that any consumer short-term loan involving a borrower in Minnesota is governed under Minnesota law, and finally sets forth a new and improved. There's an existing private right of action. It's a little confusingly drafted, and this one sets forth a more typical private right of action in consumer finance regulation in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Your other testifier, if you can identify yourself for the tape, please, and show your last name.
My name is Kari Rudd, K-A-R-I-R-U-D-D.
Welcome to the committee. Continue on.
Mr. Chair and members, I would like to briefly lay out a scenario of how this bill would impact a typical payday borrower.
If you can do it briefly.
I will do it very briefly. Right now, a borrower takes out a $300 payday loan, for example, and then 2 weeks later, $300 will be deducted from their paycheck. And if the borrower needs that $300 for something else, that would be a reason why someone would need to take out another payday loan, which is why we see the scenario that Mr. Elwood was discussing, where borrowers will take out many payday loans in a year. Under this bill, a borrower could roll over the payday loan two times as they do currently, but if after that second rollover, if they needed that $300 to pay other bills, they would have a conventional loan where they're able to pay it off in bi-weekly installments that pay down their debt rather than paying a fee in order to roll over the entire debt of $300. And because those installments would be $1 less than taking out a new payday loan, that would make it a more affordable option for a borrower and would discourage them from going to another payday lender. And so, in a nutshell, that would be how this bill would play out.
Okay. Questions to the witnesses. Questions from members. Yeah, Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I believe for the professor, you said you're a University of Minnesota professor. Is this a position of the University of Minnesota? Is this a position that the U is taking here in this bill today?
Professor Cox?
No, it's not a university position. Associate professor of clinical law. I run a consumer protection clinic as well as teach other courses at the University of Minnesota Law School. Right now, for instance, I'm teaching civil procedure. The clinic takes cases and projects. This is no more a position of the University of Minnesota than when we represent borrowers in predatory lending transactions, for instance, and we take certain positions on the interpretation of laws.
Okay. Representative Zeller,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. The private right of action that you spoke of, Mr. Prentice Cox, you said this is going to allow for a greater or a wider interpretation. I guess I'd like to expand.
Zeller, can you cite the page number?
You know, I'm looking for it, Mr. Chairman, and I
think it's 5.26 in that area someplace.
I believe so, Mr. Chairman. It was... you said this is going to, I won't use your words, you said it's going to expand or allow a wider interpretation or something. Are we just going to see more lawsuits and in the end the consumer is the one that gets got in between the two lawyers?
Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there already is a private right of action regarding payday lending. There's a private right of action as to all effective consumer finance, consumer protection laws. This simply implements similar private right of action than such as exists under the law you looked at earlier, which I and a member of the audience, Mr. Pat Sexton, worked on together 5 years ago. Chapter 325N has a very similar private right of action, as do many Minnesota consumer finance laws.
President, follow up for you.
Well, no, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just
very good.
The term expanded and private right of action always gives me the willies, but that's just a
any other questions standpoint. From the members of, if not, then thank you very much. And people that are scheduled, I think, in opposition. We have Paul Cassidy, Remy Stone. Remy Stone and Brad Nixon is on the list. If you can try your best to have short testimony, we appreciate that. And welcome to the committee. You can identify yourself to the tape, please, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Paul Cassidy. I'm with the Minneapolis law firm of Leonard Street and Dinard, and I'm here today to speak in opposition to House File 914 on behalf of our client, Payday America, a Minnesota corporation. Let me first start out by saying that this legislation before you today will effectively shut down the ability of the lending industry to offer payday-type loans to Minnesota consumers. This bill will effectively eliminate $70 million in short-term credit currently available to Minnesota consumers during the worst economic circumstances of our generation. You would also be cutting off 20,000 Minnesotans who each year access short-term capital at a time when it is estimated that over 1,000 individuals a week are losing their jobs. Last year, Payday America assisted thousands of Minnesota consumers who are in need of short-term loans. Under current law, Payday America is able to assist those consumers with a short-term solution to a short-term cash dilemma. This legislation is a solution in search of a problem. We are unaware of any, and I repeat any, complaints that have been filed with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office or the Minnesota Department of Commerce regarding regulated payday lending and the products they offer. The current law was contemplated years ago to protect citizens from unscrupulous characters who operated underground and who took advantage of workers in need of short-term cash solutions. Individuals were being taken advantage of. Policymakers decided we needed a law. The law was created to bring those transactions above board and put reasonable laws and regulations in place to protect Minnesota citizens. was it contemplated that these types of loans that were short-term transactions with high interest rates and fees? Of course it was. The lawmakers also understood at the time that there were a number of things, including without regulation, the business of short-term lending would go underground and individuals would be taken advantage of. Second, people would turn to our border states where transactions are either unregulated or where fees and interest rates are exorbitant and significantly higher. And finally, one thing they probably didn't contemplate was the advent of the Internet, where the Internet has the ability to lure individuals at the touch of a button. Today, unscrupulous lenders can provide you instantaneous short-term cash on the Internet, a remarkable convenience, but at an unregulated cost both financially and personally. Many of these Internet lenders, many of whom operate offshore, thereby untouchable, charge exorbitant fees and use frightening collection practices. The current law is just another level of authorized, the current law is just another level of funding, lending authorized in Minnesota law. As a viable business, Payday America made a decision based on market factors and customer need that they would subject themselves to a higher level of government regulation in order to offer their customers short-term loans on a signature and a handshake. The business had to demonstrate the financial wherewithal and integrity to pass muster with regulators in exchange for the ability to offer these types of loans, which average around $350 per transaction. As you make your decision today, I ask you to keep a few thoughts in mind. Customers of payday lending institutions turn to us because they have no other alternative. Don't drive these consumers to the Internet, the border states, or worse yet, underground to unscrupulous lenders working in the black market. Minnesota law allows for varying levels of lending. It always has. These loans are just one more lending tool allowed by Minnesota law to assist Minnesota consumers who may be in an emergency financial situation and have no other alternative. It keeps the transaction above board and protects consumers who might otherwise have no other alternative. Finally, I'll leave you with one final thought. The types of loans you're addressing today are done on a signature and handshake. They are not large, long-term loans. Discussions of high annual percentage rates are red herrings. These are short-term transactions done on a signature and a handshake. The average fee charged by Payday America on an average $350 loan is less than 10% of the loan amount, or less than $35. These fees are less than the fees charged by your very own financial institutions on similar types of short-term loans, which this bill does not address or attempt to regulate. In addition, fees charged for non-sufficient funds, check overdrafts, credit card late fees, and public utility reconnection fees are far more when compared to the cost of a comparable $100 loan from Payday America. Mr. Chairman and members, keep these transactions above board and accessible to Minnesota consumers. Let's take time to discuss how to make the transactions better and how we might better protect Minnesota from bad actors. We're open and willing to discuss this legislation and how we might better protect our consumers on the back end of these transactions, but we're here today to register our opposition to this bill to this effect on individuals' access to short-term credit. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Mr. Cassidy, thank you. Remy, if you can identify yourself for the tape, please. So your last name.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Remy Stone, R-E-M-I-S-T-O-N-E. I represent Advance America, the nation's largest payday lender. We operate in 33 states, plus the U.K. and Canada. I have the delight and challenge to work on payday lending issues in 12 Midwest states and in Washington, D.C. We are a monoline company. This means that our sole product, our core product, is payday lending, a cash advance off your next paycheck. Our company does not operate in the state of Minnesota, although we would like to. The state's regulatory scheme is tremendously restrictive and cost prohibitive. The market in Minnesota has already spoken to this matter, as entry into or even expansion into the state is virtually non-existent. Competition has found a delicate equilibrium in this extreme regulatory structure here in Minnesota. Members, Minnesota's payday lending rate structures are the lowest in the nation before the product is no longer viable and therefore no longer available to customers as a regulated storefront product. To help you put this in context, in Wisconsin, Goodwill, in partnership with another nonprofit, Prospera Credit Union, they moved to offer, and they still do, a product called Good Money. Good Money is a payday loan. They charge $9.90 per $100. For a $300 loan, the charge is $29.70.
According to their own documents, the product, if offered at break-even, with nearly half going to write off bad loans and the rest to database services and administrative costs. And interestingly, these tax-exempt status companies are just breaking even on the product. In Minnesota, that same $300 loan has charges $23, and it's offered by a for-profit tax business. I don't know how they do it. Our corporate folks don't know how they do it. Our CFO has no idea how they do it. You have to hand it to the Minnesota homegrown companies for running super efficient businesses under this regulatory scheme. Any restrictive tinkering with the delicate regulatory balance in Minnesota has the very real potential of eliminating the product. I strongly urge you to not upset the balance you have in this state. We know from experience that when regulated storefront products leave a state, customers lose out. We know this for a fact. Just recently, the FDIC has studied the issue and released some data that is interesting, I think, for you to consider. It tells us that consumers are critical to mention when they're considering this product over other products is cost. It has been found that when this market choice is eliminated, when payday lending goes away, consumers do the following. Because they're no longer able to make a cost decision to choose a payday loan, they are late on bills on purpose, incurring late charges and risking the use of that service. Often it's the utility that they're risking. They use credit card advances, provided they have access to a balance available. They file Chapter 7 bankruptcy. They seek non-regulated funding sources, offshore, underground, on the internet. They bounce checks, and a whole lot of them. The FDIC's 2008 study on bounce checks tells us that nationally customers bounce 13 checks a year. My company, we have an experience rate of 7 to 8 payday loans per customer. The average overdraft protection fee is $27, regardless of what's bound. Put that in context. You can bounce a $4 overdraft at your credit union, and they will charge you $27. You can take a $300 loan out here in Minnesota, and they will charge you $23. In fact, the FDIC's study shows that the national average in overdraft protections is the following. The average nationally is $368. In states where payday lending does not exist, overdraft protection costs, the fees consumers pay, is $541. In states where there is payday lending, it's $240. Specifically for this bill, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Stone, if you can kind of split it up a bit.
This database, we know from experience databases exist in 9 states. The companies that are harmed are your small mom-pops. That's your very demographic here in the state. You will harm the small companies. And quite frankly, the 2-year rollover idea, or the two loans per year, you're driving consumers into more expensive alternate products, and you're not serving their interests. It's not going to solve the debt trap. What we really need to do is have comprehensive financial literacy so that people know how to use mortgages, credit cards, title lending, payday lending. That's the solution here. It's not restricting access to a single product. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions to the witnesses. Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to our attorneys. Well, first of all, you said that there were some surrounding states that had higher costs, and I was wondering if you'd give us an idea, because that we hadn't heard that at least so far we'd heard that if Minnesota was the high and the other states were falling in line. What are some of the other surrounding, pick 2 or 3, Wisconsin or North Dakota, whatever, whichever
sure.
one.
Thank you. I'd be happy to do that. In fact, I was just in, I'll give you Iowa. I was in Iowa this week. They charge... I'll give you off the top of my head. In Iowa, on a $300 cash advance, they charge $38.50. In Wisconsin, we charge $22.100. I want to tell you that in South Dakota, we're at $15.100. And do you have? So, I mean, those are examples. I have the full, I have every state rate if you're interested in that.
Representative Zeller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, another question about that, about those lawsuits under, Mr. Cassidy, under 5.3, it says, or 5.32, it says a private right of action of this section by an aggrieved debtor in this section is a public interest. Now, if I'm not an attorney, but if I remember right, isn't that where we generate our class actions? We got a bunch of these folks together, put them in a grieved group, or accumulate all their debt. Couldn't we come to a class action lawsuit under that section,
Mr. Cassidy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zeller, yes, we believe this would be a great expansion of that, and just creating a new opportunity for class action lawsuits.
Well, Representative Zeller,
thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Cassidy, what would that mean to the not only this employer, but what would mean we'd be setting precedents across not only Minnesota but across the country if they were to do this here in Minnesota,
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zeller, absolutely. Obviously, this is language that we see in a lot of bills around here. But it's language that would offer the opportunity for the trial bar to create class action lawsuits against the industry. It would set a precedent, I think. It would also make Minnesota a target. And right now that I'm aware of, in terms of an industry in Minnesota, we have very little litigation, very few problems. And this would, I think, spur some creativity.
Can I have a follow-up?
You got the gavel, of course. You got, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Stone or Mr. Cassidy, are there other states that have this type of language?
Mr. Chairman,
language that exists on 5.32 and 3.3.
Mr. Chairman, I know for a fact that in Wisconsin arbitration prohibitions do not exist. They've tried to do that through rulemaking, but it's not happened. I can get the committee a list of all the arbitration provisions, but I want to tell you there's maybe two or three nationally. And I might be completely wrong. There may be zero.
So, Mr. Elwood, do you have an answer to my question?
Well, if you're asking me about what other states allow private rights of action, I'm going to defer to Professor Cox, but I would like to respond to the question that Representative Zeller asked about class actions, and I hate to disagree with my colleague, Mr. Cassidy, but he's actually got it exactly opposite. And in fact, what this provision would do would be to discourage class actions and allow individual actions to take place. So what this does is, in 2000, the Minnesota Supreme Court provided or handed down a decision which essentially effectively eliminated, under our private attorney general statute, the ability of individuals to take actions and force everybody into a class action posture. This would do just the opposite. It would actually discourage class actions and just deal with people on a one-to-one basis. So it's exactly the opposite of your concern. And in fact, it actually should allay your concerns.
Representative Mahoney?
Mr. Chair, rather than just having the opponents up to the table, could we get Professor Cox up to the witness table?
So yep. This is the time now for us to be able to ask both sides. That's fine. Mr. Cox. Professor Cox?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make the same comment Ron Elwood did. That provision is showing up in a lot of your consumer protection bills in response to what wasn't said, in response to a 2000 Supreme Court decision. Frankly, you should overturn. This eliminated the ability of individuals to bring consumer protection actions because it's not in the public benefit if it's just one individual with the ruling.
Okay, I should ask if there's anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify against the bill at the present time. We didn't allow the audience that opportunity. Is there anybody for or against the bill, either side? Seeing none, then other questions to the witnesses. Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had one, and it was one of the first questions, and this is... and a lot of these things, we're writing bills in search of solutions, and I want to make sure and get this on the record. Mr. Cassidy, I probably can take care of it, the question about the complaint to the Department of Commerce or to the Attorney General's office. And
sure.
I want Mr. Cassidy, you know, be very honest with us, how many or what's the total, or, you know, here in Minnesota, not the anecdotal around our surrounding states, but here in Minnesota.
Mr. Cassidy, can you answer that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zellers, I am unaware of any complaints against local payday lenders in Minnesota. We have been told by the Commerce Department they've had inquiries on Internet payday lenders, but I am unaware of complaints that have been filed either at the Attorney General's office or at the Minnesota Department of Commerce.
Okay, maybe someone else can.
Sure, Mr. Elwood,
if you would identify yourself. Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair, Ron Elwood, Legal Aid again, and members, I just want to point out, in some cases, complaint numbers to the Department of Commerce and to the Attorney General are indicative of great problems. In other cases, and this would be a quintessential case, people who are in this situation do not complain. They are embarrassed. They also know exactly what they're getting into. They understand they're in trouble. They know the prices they're paying for these loans. They're not going to. What are they going to complain about? They're going to complain about the fact that the prices are too high. They're not going to do it. They're embarrassed and they don't come forward. I can tell you for a fact that I have tried to encourage some folks that have gotten into this trap to come here and testify, and I have gotten the same reaction from all of these folks. I'm sorry, but I'm embarrassed to come into a public forum, especially the legislature, and tell people that I'm in this situation. So in this particular case, as others, the lack of complaints are not indicative of the magnitude of the problem.
Okay. Other questions from Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a few questions about some of the customers that are participating in the payday lending process. And I don't know if Mrs. Stone wants to answer a few questions as well with her customer, but I'm just wondering what type of documents need to be provided from these customers. Someone's car breaks down, they want to come in for a short-term loan so they can continue driving to work. What kind of documents do they need to provide in order to acquire the loan? What measures are taken to protect both you as the lender and them as their ability to repay?
Ms. Stone?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Mack. Hello. Our customers are 100% employed. They have to have a job. They have to have income coming in. We require proof of that income to initiate them in the product. We have them bring in their most recent bank statements. So they are not unbanked. They have a banking relationship. They choose this product for other reasons. They need to have proof of identification. And we will verify not only income, but also their place of employment. It's interesting you asked the question about how do we protect our own interests. There's an assumption out there if somebody's making $1,000 that we'll lend them $1,000. But we don't do that. Depending upon where we are and what state and what the demographic looks like and what the state law is, we will qualify based on our monthly gross income. So that we don't put them upside down. It's in our best interest to have them pay us back.
What is the method?
And as far as that goes, what is the method of repayment? Is a customer, are there online options? Do they have to come in and pay cash or debit cards? What are the methods of repayment? And can it be automatically taken out of the check? I think with a testifier earlier that alluded to the fact that you know, maybe their check is that much less because it's just automatically taken out. Is that possible, and how does that repayment work?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I can tell you how our company works, and I'll answer the question about the ACH thing that you're asking about. Our company, we will actually hold a check until somebody comes and buys it back, if you will, so there's a cash transaction. We give them the check back unless they specifically let us know that they're willing to have that deposited. Okay. Other companies operate differently, and I think that your concern about the automatic electronic withdrawal out of their accounts, we know that that is happening regularly when people are engaging on Internet transactions, because what happens is people put in all their financial information, all their personal data, and then when that loan comes due, rather than waiting for the and we'll hold a check for as long as state law lets us. Usually we'll hold it up to a week. But what they do, instead of checking with the customer, they will automatically debit out of that account, and this very much like overdraft protection, they'll keep spiraling people into additional charges.
Okay, if we can kind of have short answers and short questions, please. We need to be moving to.
I just have one last question. What is the average default rate for both of your companies?
Mr. Cassidy?
Mr. Chairman, from the MAC, the average default we've been running the last couple of years is about 2%, and that is due to, first of all, very, very happy customers. The fact that the company works very, very closely with clients and customers that are having problems with payment. And as we stated before, we don't put customers on the debt treadmill, as some would seem to imply today.
Okay. A very short answer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative. Nationally, we experience a 96% return rate. We have an initial 92%. And then that last 4% we're able to recover.
Okay. Other quick questions? If not, then Representative Sanders, you're on the list.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may be a question for the professor. Subdivision 8, if I could have some clarification as far as the jurisdiction goes. One, are we, regulating other states basically with this? So basically, if someone physically, is it possible to physically get a payday loan if you're a Minnesota resident in the state of Iowa? Or is this aimed at internet type loans? And then are we obligating them under the Minnesota statute, or would it be Iowa's? Would it be both? I'm not exactly clear the aim and the scope of sub 8.
Hey, Professor Cox, a quick answer, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sanders, yes, Minnesota law is to control the transaction, whether it's over the internet or not, if it's with a Minnesota resident.
Okay. Other questions? If not, then I think we've heard testimony on both sides, and Representative Davenport.
Mr. Chair and members, over the last decade, due to lax regulatory oversight and short-term cultural values, we've seen an enormous tsunami of irresponsible lending and imprudent borrowing. As our economy unwinds, it's our responsibility to make sure there are things in place for our constituents. With that, Mr. Chair, I would like to renew my motion. That House File 914 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
And carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I don't get to tell the chair off.
That was nicely done, Mr. Colbert.
Representative Knuth. Members, we would like to get to the house bill today. These were rather itchy to be getting home, even though the ice houses are required to be off the lake by, I think, earlier this week. So,
but you can still go
What number is it? 250, all right. The chair would like to move House File 250. Excuse me. So, you're first. Would you like to move House File 250?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 250 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Outstanding. Representative Knuth, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a couple amendments.
All right.
Take care of those first.
Please. The Representative Fritz, would you like to move the H0250 DE5 amendment to be before the committee?
Mr. Chair, I move the DE5 amendment.
Representative Knuth, this is your bill to get. This is your amendment to get the bill in the order you prefer.
Yep, and we also have a.
We'll take them one at a time.
We'll take them one at a time. Okay.
Kind of, sort of. Okay. Well, this is an interesting parliamentary routine. Representative Fritz, would you like to
move the A3 amendment be incorporated into the DE5 amendment?
So moved.
Brevity and efficiency. With that, members, move the DE5 amendment as amended by the incorporation of the A3 amendment to be before the committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Do we have another? We're done with amendments. Representative Knuth, see your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is basically trying to get at, I think, a very basic consumer protection of making sure our products are safe for children, and it basically assesses, evaluates, and then tries to determine if there's safer alternatives to chemicals and products, and if there are safer alternatives, then phases them out. And I have you should have a news article about a recent report from the Government Accountability Office stating that the EPA is not doing this very well in a way that protects the environment and the public health of citizens of our country. And so this bill is trying to deal with that. The amendment changes some of the format. It changes a little bit of the way we prioritize these chemicals. And if you have an American Electronics Association opposition letter, it puts that amendment into the bill as well. So the way I read their letter, they should no longer be concerned with this bill. And I'm getting a note to try to limit my comments to section 6 and 7 of the bill, which are about prohibiting sales of certain priority chemicals, and then also waivers for specific uses. Got that note from the CA.
Pardon. Thank you for that, because I believe it is only Section 6 and 7 that are germane to the jurisdiction of this committee, and that is the chair's preference,
okay,
that we limit ourselves to, okay, issues that are germane to this committee.
So with the amendment, we have priority chemicals, which are chemicals that are cancer-causing, endocrine-disrupting, as well as chemicals that are found in children's products, our bodies, or our environment, or are highly persistent and bioaccumulative. Within that, this amendment has level 1 and level 2 priority chemicals, which we're assessing for safer alternatives. If we can't find a safer alternative, it's level 2, and they'll have to continue to look for safer alternatives to that chemical. If there is determined that a safer alternative is available, that chemical will be phased out through a process that you can read here. I think looking at Section 5, there's information about what's in products, which I think is an important consumer protection, getting that information out there as well. But with that, Mr. Chair, I will. I have a testifier here who could give some more background, or we could also just stand for questions.
What's your preference, Representative Knuth?
Okay, well, why don't we just stand for questions?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, and through the bill author, is a member that I served with for many years, used to ask, is there peace in the valley on this bill?
Representative Knuth, how's the mountaintop, how's the valley?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I don't think the American Chemistry Council is a fan of my bill, because we are changing the way that we would get at assessing, evaluating, and regulating our chemicals. I think we have a basic philosophical difference. I've been continuing to meet with manufacturers and retailers, and we don't have all of their concerns totally addressed in this yet, but we're working towards that, and I'm continuing those discussions.
Representative Fulbert.
I don't want to go to where I shouldn't go.
Please don't.
But I'm going to just a different section, but I see some references to it is in Section 7 as well. And that is on Section 12 and another one. It's been a narrow focus on this for children, but mm-hmm. there is also a broader focus on all consumer products. And I just, you know, children is one thing, consumer products is a different kind of regulation. And I think some of those concerns are addressed also in Section 6 and 7. It's an expansion of it. I would hope that the author would be consistent in making sure that we are focusing on children's products first.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, and the bill is focusing on children's products until we get to B, paragraph B in section 12, which is, you know, we think children are, they're more susceptible to chemicals and toxins, and they can have long-term consequences that aren't always immediately obvious, and that's why we want to make sure children are our priority. But looking, I also believe all citizens, residents need to be protected, and so we want the PCA to take a pretty substantial amount of time and be thoughtful in a process of coming back with other recommendations or options for making, for protecting everyone.
Follow-up, President Silver.
So that's just to be clear, that's a report back in several years. It's not any type of evaluation or regulation.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll beg maybe a little same latitude as you gave Representative Solberg. It applies to Section 6 and 7, but as the saying goes, you can't get the bird till you kill a cow, right?
I'll grant you that.
On page 4, when it identifies the safe alternatives, under one of the sections, and this is maybe for Representative Canoes, some of the other stuff is, you know, scientific literature, Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse, I understand some of that, but the thing that really is leaves the barn door pretty much wide open, in my standpoint, I'm just going to make sure Representative Knuth, the author of the bill, on line 4.12, may, in the absence of persuasive evidence to the contrary, presume that. To me, Mr. Chairman, and if the author can help me with that, that seems awfully wide open.
Representative Knuth, briefly, since this is in the gray area.
Again.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, when we're looking for safer alternatives, this is a list that basically is giving us easier options than looking at all of the scientific evidence, because it's kind of basically the scientific evidence has been looked at in other cases. So if there's not persuasive evidence to the contrary, if it's not on the chemical of high concern list, if it's not on any of those scientific lists that say cancer, endocrine disrupting, reproductive toxin, those sorts of things, then we can assume it's a safer alternative. If this children's product, this product containing this priority chemical is in another state, has been prohibited for sale within another state, we're assuming we want to be at least as safe as those other states to protect Minnesota's children. If it's an apparel or novelty item, it's not a necessary item. We would assume there's a different way to do it if it's not totally necessary to the function of that product. And if there's another alternative sold in the United States that's not been banned or regulated in another way, we assume that it's a safer alternative. So, you can read it. I just went through it. It's a set of criteria that the agencies can use to make that determination. And I think they are...
Mr.
Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that kind of proves the point of the question. I mean, the persuasive argument is in the eye of the beholder, Mr. Chair. And if persuasive is 5 studies to me, it might be to Chair Dabney 15 studies, depending on the issue, depending on what chemical. And it's not, you know, I think it's wide open. But, Mr. Chairman, I will go to Section 6 and 7 if I can have
you.
A question. About the once you've been put on the ban list, can you walk me through the process? Because there's a lot of pages in here for how you get on the list and then the waiver process, and it's awfully confusing, and I'm just trying to figure out how we're going to do this in a timely manner if we're going to ban a product and we later find out that it wasn't necessarily supposed to be on the ban list. This process looks awfully long and complicated. I just want, if you can just walk me through the steps, I would appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Knuth.
So basically, once we've determined a safer alternative is available through using the criteria we've stated or through another process, the agency can determine the prohibition or to prohibit this product containing this chemical from being distributed or sold in this state. And then they give a notice to the manufacturer so they know, and within 180 days, or at least 180 days after, they could set a date for prohibition. And so basically what a manufacturer can do, they can decide not to offer that product for sale, or they can obtain a waiver, which we'll get to later, if they can show why the exposure isn't significant in this certain use and why it might not be quite as technically this feasible, although that's part of the safer alternative process, or replace it with a safer alternative, so we phase out this chemical. And then they have to submit a plan to the agency about how they're going to do this. And you know, this does put some of the manufacturers, are just, they have to do some work here. But frankly, you know, they're selling products that have chemicals we're concerned about as causing problems, health and safety problems in our children. So I think that's a pretty reasonable thing. Once they've done the phase out, they have to put a certificate of compliance in with the agency to say that they've done it. And they also have to notify retailers that this product is being phased out, because this isn't trying to regulate the retailer level. It's the manufacturer distributor level. And then there's a sale of inventory exemption, so if a retailer has a certain amount of a product containing the priority chemical, they can sell it. So then there's the waiver process, and the commissioner can decide if not having a certain children's product poses unreasonable risk to our public health or safety. So that's somewhat of a waiver, but it's a determination by the commissioner. Otherwise, the manufacturer distributing this product will have to explain why they think their product should be sold, if it contains the priority chemical, the level one priority chemical, and making sure that we have an understanding within our agency of why they believe that this chemical should continue to be used. And looking back, I mean, it can seem like a lot, but when we're looking at what we're trying to get at with this, is we have basically decades of chemical regulation that's not protecting the health of our citizens. And the burden has continually been just on our public entities to say, wait, that's not safe. After TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act, was signed into law by Gerald Ford, we've had 200 chemicals evaluated and only five phased out. And this it helps the chemical companies and manufacturers explain why they need to use this product, even though it can has cancer, endocrine, toxic properties to it.
Zellers, briefly. We would like to get to the House bill. There seems to be a couple of people in the audience with an interest in that one.
Sure. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Knuth, the emotional part of it I get and understand. I have two small children, you bet. My concern with this bill is we're putting a jungle gym of proof, non-proof, and open to interpretation rules into place, that if you've done nothing wrong, your product has been found not to do anything wrong, you have to then jump through 14 or 15 different hoops, along with your retailer, who, if you own a hardware store, say in central Minnesota, you've got to check the list every other day on, is this on, is it off, do I have to take it off, do I hold it in stock for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. So now we're asking our retailers to be our warehousers for products they can't sell. Again, if you apply for a waiver, I don't understand how the waiver process goes. If you're the manufacturer, do I tell the hardware store, well, I'm applying for a waiver, so can you just put it in the back for a while? Or I got 180 days. The burden of proof isn't necessarily, you know, back on the manufacturer here. You've got a go-between, and I don't know that with the other part of the bill we'd like to get to, Mr. Chairman, but I understand we won't. I think you've created a process here that's going to, in the long run, not only provide an opportunity for confusion, but it'll probably just mean that folks will decide, you know what, we'll just not do business in Minnesota. And, you know, when we're in a time of economic downturn, Mr. Chairman, I, again, don't think this is a good idea to put into law unless you've got the proof. And if that one line back there, the absence of a persuasive evidence, to me leaves the door wide open. I think this is an awfully big, I wouldn't call it bold, confusing point that's got a lot of holes in it.
Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify either for or against this legislation? Sir. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Easter. That's E-A-S-T-E-R, like the holiday. Mm-hmm. And I'm the Midwest Director of State Government Affairs for the American Chemistry Council. And Kathleen Roberts from our technical regulatory technical division has testified earlier, but she has gone on to other employment opportunities, so I'm here today. And we're pleased to offer comments on House File 250 by Representative Knuth. It's a top priority for the American Chemistry Council to protect children from harmful exposures to chemicals in various products. And we support many concepts of the bill, although we have a number of recommendations for improvement.
Mr. Easter, just a question. Are you limiting your comments to Section 6 and 7 of the bill? Because as we reviewed, those are the only parts that are under the jurisdiction of this committee.
Well, my comments are within the scope of some of the discussion that's been here, if I may. We recommend that to apply the existing scientific information that is out there. There's a lot of other activities going on at the federal level and other states. We would recommend rigorously evaluating the potential risks from exposures to chemical uses of concern in certain consumer and institutional products. Prioritize chemical uses of concern with high priority for uses that have greatest potential for exposures to children. Will help assure that limited resources are effectively and efficiently applied. And legislation should provide a transparent process that affords all stakeholders, including affected businesses, the opportunity for comment and input on the assessment of chemical uses of concern, including a scientific basis for listing of proposed management measures and the potential alternatives for certain chemical uses. Our concerns about the bill is that it's primarily based on hazard criteria and lacks exposure assessments. Those things together are what constitute risk. The bill primarily relies just on presence of chemicals and as opposed to thresholds of how much is in a product as a measure for what would be acceptable under risk criteria. In the definition of alternatives, it's using functionally equivalent. That definition lacks factors such as quality, feasibility, risks, or cost, which are important to manufacturers and retailers involved. And again, many things happening at the other levels. TSCA reform at the federal level. Just last week, Congressman Waxman initiated discussions on reforms. It's long overdue, we agree. I think it's a top priority of EPA and President Obama. So you're going to see activity at the federal level on the very issues you're talking about here today. Reintroduction of the Kids Safe Chemicals Act by Waxman is expected. The other states that are working on this are Maine, Washington, and California have adopted similar legislation, and we've participated with those states and would encourage that the state of Minnesota take advantage of those resources as well instead of trying to reinvent the wheel. That a lot of that information is already there. Main point today, and I'll wrap up, is that we strongly encourage the sponsors to consider amending the bill to focus not just on hazards, which does a good job of that, but also on actual exposure risks in children's products as well. And that's a brief of my testimony.
All right.
I'd be happy to answer any
questions. Thanks, Mr. Easter. Representative Mahoney, brief question?
As brief as I can make it, Representative Knuth, do you have a provision in the bill, because granted I haven't read anything other than the two sections here, that if federal legislation is passed, federal legislation supersedes or this anything like that, so that we don't have 50 different regulations across the nation?
Mr. Easter. Oh, my apologies. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney. In terms of the federal preemption, this is kind of one of those gray areas. Frankly, if it's this is a different way of dealing with safe chemicals, instead of just saying, okay, we're trying to figure out the science and fight that out in our legislatures or our agencies or what have you, and we're figuring what's okay of a toxic chemical, well, how much exposure, and we go back to look at different ways of doing that. This is basically saying we think it's important to try to move towards safer chemicals over time and to have a process to do that and promote green chemistry and the health of our people. And so I think it's hard to say what way the federal government will go. And I know, I'm guessing I know what way.
That would be no, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
with the consumer product safety stuff that came out with the lead and the phthalates, the federal government put a preemption in there, so it makes it across the board nationally, and I would assume that the American Chemistry Council would support that at the federal level as the preemption language.
All right. Representative Lilly, did you indicate a desire to speak?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Knuth. It's kind of a funny story. My son's a chemist, so we're through the mail, we're always getting interested in boxes at the house, and I'm always a little afraid to see what's in them, but always leads for funny little demonstrations in our backyard as he blows up stuff for different things like that. But perhaps they are.
Can you identify yourself for the tape, Representative Willie?
Now, regards to Section 6 and, you know, impacts to sales. For me, I just recently, and maybe you saw it, Senator Klobuchar was on the news expressing problems with batteries, for example, with Arctic Cat and Polaris, and we, you know, kind of going to what maybe Mr. Representative Zellers was kind of maybe trying to get at some too. I mean, some of the unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we all have our little fancy cell phones. And so you early on said you've dealt with some of that, but with the technology kind of thing. But so can you give me some comfort to say that, you know, we're not going to be banning Arctic Cat and Polaris or kitty cats around the state of Minnesota or that sort of thing?
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you go to Section 9, you can see the whole list of what that's applicable to, and to make sure, you know, where motor vehicles are not included, combustion byproducts, agricultural products, pharmaceutical products, medical devices, food and beverage, or beverage packing, except for baby food and infant formula. Now it includes the amendment with the electronics, so it's really trying to get at children's products, and these are some of its comfort language. I don't think children's products are going to have agriculture production chemicals in them, at least I hope not, but there's the list that could give you that comfort.
Representative
Chair and Representative Knuth, thank you for that comment.
With that, Representative Fritz renews her motion that House File 250, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Howes, the fish are calling. I've heard several different ways on that one. So, Representative Howes, welcome back to the committee. We miss you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I avoided this committee because I thought I could go home on Thursday night, but I guess here I am again.
Here you are again, but it's as always, good to have you here. Representative Mahoney, would you like to move House File 1056?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair.
All right. With that, House File 1056 has been recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Howes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe first off, if I could ask Representative Lilly if he'd sign on to my fireworks bill, since his son is a chemist, and since this bill has traveled through a road of fireworks, but now I believe we're okay.
Which would call for a fireworks event.
Exactly.
I pledge to look at your bill, sir.
Thank you.
All right.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the ice fish houses on Leech Lake are still up, and they do allow smoking inside of them.
We got a new law to talk about.
Mr. Chairman and members, House File 1056 deals with the prompt payment to subcontractors law, and there have been rumors abounding as to exactly what this law does or does not do. What it simply does is put back the residential end of the construction industry. That is all it does. It doesn't change contract law, lending laws, or anything of that nature. I will tell you that there has been, it started out as the Ozzy and Harriet Show, went to Death Valley Days, and now I think we're in Happy Days. So it's seen the course up and down. I'm working, have a lot of subcontractors in here that would, if they just raise their hand and show their support. I also have support from the 49ers and the Building and Construction Trade Council, and I believe the Builders Association of Minnesota. There's some folks here if they want to raise their hand. We have agreed.
She's a frequent flyer here in the committee.
Yes, I believe that the Builders Association does have a question on a part of it that they still want to work with me and the subcontractors on. It's not the end of the world, but they wanted me for the record to say that they are still working on that, and they have a very good working relationship. At this time, I believe I would like it to go to Commerce, and if there is a problem, that it certainly will be taken care of before it gets there.
Very good, Representative House. I do need to ask if there's anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 1056. Hot diggity. With that, Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House File... Oh, I could ask if members have any questions. No? Okay, hot diggity again. Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House File 1056 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed. Motion prevails. Minute. Representative Nelson, have you read the minutes?
Yes, I have.
Okay, minutes. Representative Nelson moves approval of the February 27th. Minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion prevails. We stand adjourned. Thank you, everyone.